WATD presents Monday Night Talk with your host, Kevin Tachi.
If it's Monday night, it's got to be Monday Night Talk with Kevin Tachi. So thanks for having me on.
Kevin, good for you to hold back and let him tell his story.
Putting the South Shore spin on politics, current events, and pop culture.
You guys are the center of the universe today, at least the political universe.
I believe both of you are from the area. Marshfield guys, yes, no?
Correct, yeah.
That's right.
There's only one person not from Marshfield in this room right now. And it's you.
It's me. I'm the outcast.
Well, you've always been generous with the time. I appreciate it very much.
Well, I'm honored to be on your show tonight, Kevin, with that impressive lineup you have.
I believe our guest that we've been waiting for, Congressman Stephen Lynch.
Kevin, good to join you.
The governor of the Commonwealth, Charlie Baker. You ready?
I got to tell you that it was really nice to hear Aerosmith on the intro there.
You're going
to
be the rock and roll governor?
I don't know about that. But
we have Mayor Joe Sullivan joining us. Sir, how are you?
Well, Kevin, very good to be with you again.
Dr. Drew Pinsky. Dr. Drew, are you there?
I'm here. Thanks for having me.
Mr. Ming Tsai, welcome to the show, sir.
Hey, thanks, Kevin.
Massachusetts State Auditor Suzanne Bump. Hello, Auditor. How are you?
I am fine, and I'm delighted to be with you this evening.
And now, your host, Kevin Tachi.
Welcome to Monday Night Talk, and we also welcome Joe Rossi back to the fold. He will sit in as my co-host. What are you laughing about?
Nothing. I was expecting something snide coming out of your mouth as my
Oh, the night is young.
In a while.
The night is young. But Joe is good. Joe is here wearing two hats. As he'll be here as a co-host.
I will.
And he'll also be here to discuss the latest as to what's going on with flood insurance and the National Flood Insurance Program.
It's a big deal.
Yeah, the reauthorization.
We're in the middle.
Shh. We'll just tease it. But Joe is up at 6:40 exclusively. And then prior to that, we have Mr. Fred Happel. He is running for council at large in Weymouth. We'll talk with him about his campaign. I did extend an offer for Fred to hang out for more of the show, but Fred's kind of like, yeah, I just want to come in and kind of talk about my campaign. It says, okay. But if he stays longer, you know, I have warned you. Then at 7 o'clock, the second hour, we got Dr. Frieda Birnbaum. She's a psychologist and a psychoanalyst. And we are going to talk a little bit about...
I could use one of those.
Could you really?
Yes.
All right.
She and I will have an extended discussion.
On air?
No.
Okay. This could be good. Fred, you might want to stay for this. We're going to talk about the mental state of Americans and talk about why are things so hostile and volatile when it comes to politics these days?
Should be a good discussion.
It should be a good discussion. And then this was the bait on the trap for Joe. The bait
you
on the hook.
Have something, or else I wasn't going to come in.
It was either Jimmy Johnson, who is going to soon retire after he wins another Sprint Cup.
Kevin Harvick, who won this past weekend. Yeah. Now that would have gotten me in here for longer than the hour or two.
Really?
Hours. Yeah.
Okay. But the other favorite of his, Junior D'Amato.
Yes.
He, of course, is a Monday Night Talk's own auto expert, and we're going to talk. We're going to talk about a bunch of things, not only.
I see some topics on here that I'm already thinking about.
Really? Okay. And the great part of not only talking to him about automotive stuff, but also finding out some of the stuff that he's been driving. Because on a regular basis, he is test driving vehicles. They pull up to his shop and go, hey, we're leaving this for a couple of days.
And ironically, I'm in the market, so it'll be a perfect opportunity.
Yeah, this is a Chrysler product. In here.
That's what I said when I said, look at that. It's right there. I won't be getting that car, but maybe something in that world.
All right. We'll tease it. Everybody knows that you're a Mopar guy.
I am.
Not a bad thing. Yeah. So what have you been up to since the last time we chatted?
Flood 24/7.
Really?
Yep. That's what I do every day, all day, flood. And with reauthorization happening right now, it doesn't stop. I'm on at least two or three conference calls a week with national officials trying to figure out what's going on. So,
and in case you didn't know, whether it's Joe being on this program or being a featured guest during our news program from time to time, Joe is the chair of the Marshfield Citizens Coastal Coalition.
And I sit on a few national boards as well, and we're all trying to coordinate for 2017. So, believe it or not, I have been asked to speak at a big flood conference in Montana, of all places. So, I'll be going out there this summer.
Really?
Yes.
I didn't know that there was any coastal community in Montana.
You know, everybody asked me that. Maybe I'll have more time during my segment to explain why there is so much flood activity in Montana. It has nothing to do with the flooding there.
No?
No. Nope. I'll explain more later.
Oh, wow. Joe, you've learned how to tease things while
I've taken
away.
Lessons from the best.
Really?
Not you.
I know. It's only going to get ugly from here.
Hey, I figure I'm in here only once in a while now, so I got to get you when I can.
Well, and we appreciate having you in.
I appreciate
to talk about this because it gives, while you get a chance to do something on the South Shore's Morning News from time to time, this gives you maybe a little bit of an extended conversation.
Yeah, things that we can't fit in the 5 minutes that I get in the morning. Right.
I'm excited. Are you excited? The Massachusetts legislature has proposed virtually to double the current tobacco tax. Seriously, $900 million the Commonwealth receives from tobacco tax revenue every year. I hope weed sells this good, because if the proposed taxes are passed, we're changing the name of our business. How's Brennan's in New Hampshire sound? Hey, it's Jeff from Brennan's in New Hampshire. Come buy your tobacco here, tax-free, while stocking up on your booze and fireworks. Literally stealing tax dollars from the hardworking families in Massachusetts. The truth is, the legislature depends on tobacco taxes to balance the budget in Massachusetts every legislative session. So put that in your pipe. Happy 4th of July from Brennan's Smoke Shop. Brennan's Smoke Shop, Plymouth, Pembroke, Brockton, Wareham, Raynham, Taunton, Stoughton, New Bedford, and coming soon to New Hampshire.
Download the Monday Night Talk podcast from iTunes for free. Just search for Monday Night Talk, WATD. This is Monday Night Talk with your host, Kevin Tachi.
Proud to say that promo, that back to the show liner is correct. We are back up to having all the podcasts up to date. If you've missed any of the programs, any of the segments, they are available on the website. Our first guest, a gentleman who I've had a chance to interact with from time to time prior to what he's doing now. Now he's on his own. Instead of being somebody who is working for another candidate, he is the candidate in Weymouth, running for a council at large. We have Fred Heppel joining us. Fred, welcome to Monday Night Talk.
Thank you, Kevin. Thank you for the invite. Thank you to WATD for having me. And it's nice to be with Joe again. Good to see you again.
Yeah, no, it's excellent.
You're the first one in a long time who has said that.
Well, he's a good guy.
He is. Joe is a good guy. Joe is a bright, knowledgeable guy in a lot of things. We think just flood insurance, but he knows this when it comes to politics. He knows his.
Kevin, I am just shocked how many accolades you're giving me tonight. This might be the first. I think there's more accolades being given to me by you tonight than in any time I was on the show.
Yes, mark this date on the calendar because it'll never happen again. It'll never happen again. But no, you're here to talk a little bit about running. What made you decide to run for? Is this your first time running for political office?
I was a town meeting member in Weymouth when I was 20. I got elected right out of the box. I went to UMass, got a degree in political science. I actually was Senator Hedlund's first intern up at Beacon Hill.
Wow.
Back in 1990. So I've always had the interest. I spent most of my life, unfortunately, being involved in other people's, I shouldn't say unfortunately, but I've always been involved in other people's campaigns. And I just thought it was time. This was the time to run, and I'm all in.
What's it like getting? What is it like transitioning from helping other people get out there, doing, you know, scheduling the standouts, doing phone banking? What is it like now that instead of doing it for candidate A, B, or C, you're doing it for Fred?
Well, it's interesting because I was Mayor Hedlund's campaign manager, so obviously those were a lot of my roles. And then when Senator O'Connor ran, I ran his field operation. So I made a lot of relationships over that past year. So when word came out that Senator O'Connor wasn't running, I received a lot of phone calls and a lot of encouragement from people saying, you know, why don't you give it a shot? And I thought about it, and I decided to jump right in. So a lot of those relationships that I made are now the people that are helping me now. So it's been a, even though it's a transition that now I'm the one that's the out front and in the forefront of the whole thing.
It's been
good because I know the people behind me and they're loyal and it's been great.
Joe, question?
So give us, Frank, give us a little landscape of kind of what Weymouth politics look like this year. You know, how many seats are open? How many are being challenged and set on the stage for your run?
I'm running at large, and there are 5 at large positions in the town. So obviously there's 5 incumbents right now. Out of the 5, 3 of them are running, and 2 of them have decided that they are not running. And myself and 2 other candidates have pulled papers. So as of this time, there's 6 candidates for 5 spots.
And so folks don't realize, maybe folks do or don't know, but when you're running at large, is it almost as though you're representing all of Weymouth? It isn't like being a councilman or a town councilor where, you know, a little piece of district is yours. Everything.
Correct. And it's great for me because I grew up in North Weymouth, which obviously is on one side of the town, and I currently live in South Weymouth raising my children. So I have, have made a lot of friends throughout the town. So I'm happy to run at large rather than just be restricted to one section of the town.
Is it the top vote getters? Is that how the election in Weymouth works? So it's just top.
So it'd be the 5 top vote getters. So as of right now, they'd be the top 5 out of 6, unless someone else decides to run and pulls papers.
How does that work? I mean, there's going to be a deadline when someone can pull papers, the papers, and then they got to get them in by.
Yeah, the papers came out June 1st. You need to receive 150 signatures, 25 in each district. There's 6 districts, and the signatures have to be in by August 1st.
Why not run for, town council? Why not run for, that area of town? Why go for all the marbles?
Well, the incumbent, I'm in District 6, Councilor Smart. He is not stepping down, so I would have to run against an incumbent in order to do that. So
Smart.
I thought where I have a relationship with many throughout the town, this was going to be my best shot when the opportunity arose.
The compressor station, is that the large looming issue, or are there a number of them?
Well, that's a large issue throughout the town, but specifically in North Weymouth. I mean, I actually grew up right in that area. My parents live there right now. So for me, that's a very personal issue. I mean, we grew up swimming, in that water and playing in that marsh and going on icebergs in the wintertime. So obviously that's an important issue. One of the main issues that has actually drawn me into this race is the opiate crisis, not only in the town of Weymouth, but throughout the country, throughout our region. And I have a 15-year-old in Weymouth High, and I have a 10-year-old at St. Francis. And my children are becoming that age that's a huge concern for me. And one of the things that I'm going to focus on, if elected, is that area. And my feeling is we have the older community who may be addicted, and there's a lot of conversation on how we deal with them, etc. What I want to focus on is the children. I feel that they're the ones that we have to watch over. And a couple of the ways that I want to do that is, I have pledged if I get elected that I'm going to start a jobs program, and I'm going to solicit jobs from the community, the different businesses, and try to set up a jobs program for the kids for after school and also in the summertime. The other thing is, I think that keeping our kids busy is a way to keep them away from drugs. Idle time, as we know, is the devil's playground. So we have a lot of children that obviously play sports in the town, but there's a lot of kids that don't play sports. So there's a void there for those kids. My son's one of them. My son plays the drums, and my son is now a member of the Weymouth High Band. And I grew up playing sports, and I wasn't really familiar with that area. But over the last year, I've been involved with the Weymouth High Music Boosters, and I've got to see these kids. I've seen them perform. I've seen the way they interact with each other, and it is amazing the way they look after each other. And it's not just that. We have robotics programs, you know, things that I've been involved in the town. I've been
it's
involved
a big
with
thing, the robotics.
It's the Weymouth High went to St. Louis and won a medal. And it's not just that. It's whatever activity these kids want to do. You know, I've coached flag football. I've coached my kids in baseball. I'm involved with the Boy Scouts. My son's in the Boy Scouts. And I just think we need these outlets. And one of the things that I've spoken to the mayor about is he has an application in to have a new library built, and hopefully the town is going to get that grant. And if we go forward with that, I think that's also a good opportunity where we'll have area there maybe for an outlet for these kids on a Friday night, maybe to have like a Minecraft program or something to keep the kids occupied from hanging out in the street corners, hanging out at the park, getting into trouble.
How about advancing education in regards to drugs and opioids? And how young do you feel such a program should go? I've heard, I mean, since the inception of this epidemic, a lot of folks were targeting middle school, and maybe if we go back to elementary school, maybe the fifth grade, should it go even earlier than
that? I don't see why it couldn't go back as far as we can. In Weymouth, I know that we lost the DARE program, and now we have just received grants to reestablish it. But I think the actual DARE program itself has changed over the years of the way that it initially was run to the way that it's going to be run now. Years ago, it was more of a threat to the children, you know, don't do this, this is going to happen, don't do that. And when you have a younger child and you tell them, don't touch the hot stove, what is it that they do? They go and they touch the hot stove. Mm. So I think they're trying to change the way that they're talking to the kids now, and trying a different avenue. But obviously that middle school, 7th and 8th grade, is absolutely the most vulnerable. And, you know, unfortunately, a lot of these kids, some of them come from broken homes, and right out of the gate, you know, the deck is stacked against them, and it's unfortunate. And those are the kids that we need to reach out to and try to give them some worth and feel good about themselves.
Knowing that we're talking about a sensitive thing, I was going to joke early on when you had mentioned about your son being a musician, and you mentioned the mayor. The one thing I was going to joke and say to you, are you not fearful that the mayor, who loves music, might try to influence your son? How do you feel about that?
Well, he actually has established my nickname for my son.
Has he really?
He has his own nickname for him. He calls him Sticks because he plays the drums. And actually,
leave it up to Mayor Bob Hadley.
Absolutely. One of the things that we did just last week, which was a unique thing, you know, when you get into politics, everybody has their fundraisers, and usually the fundraiser is they pick some place, you show up there, and everyone just stands there and kind of shakes hands. So we've tried to do some stuff outside the box. So last week, we had a fundraiser at the Next Page, and what we did was some friends of mine that I went to school with that are musicians got together, and we got some kids from Weymouth High School, and we just put together a huge jam. We had about 15 people. They practiced for a bit, came in, jammed, and everyone just had a blast. The mayor was there. He was requesting songs.
Of course he was.
It was great. And that was, you know, going into this campaign, talking about the opiate crisis, that was one of the things that, you know, with the musicians and getting these kids interested and just seeing their passion, and hopefully, you know, that'll keep them out of trouble.
But as far as any projects that the town is looking to embark, you mentioned the library, that's one, but others that are a passion of yours that you want to see come to fruition if you were able to be elected?
Yeah, well, there's another large project that is in the works. Again, they're looking for a grant. It would be for a new middle school, and the current middle school, I actually went to high school there. That was the old Weymouth North. That was weathered when I went there. I remember looking out the window and seeing Kazalt roof with the brush and the tar, you know, trying to stop the leaks, and that was back in the 80s. So that's something that needs to be done. That's definitely a project that I would like to see completed for the kids.
Joe, question?
Are there any major, and I know one of the priorities of the mayor has been to work on some infrastructure throughout the town, roads and that type of thing. What are some of the other pieces that you'd be, you know, looking at getting involved in? I know the new Four River Bridge is almost done. They've got the, at least the old bridge down, and there's going to be some other big projects.
Long time coming, too.
I know, in the city right now, in the town.
Yeah, well, he started... He got some grant money. He got some money together, and he is going to actually revamp most of the parks in the town. And that is another issue. When I was in high school, I played baseball for the Weymouth Legion team back in the 80s. We gave up all of our home games in order to play at Adams Field in Quincy because the fields were terrible. So that was going back in the 80s, and nothing changed throughout the years. And he's actually made an effort to fix that. So one of my concerns would be, if you're going to put all the money into fixing it, is to make sure, you know, we do the upkeep. But I think it's a great...
Strictly ball fields, or are we talking about other things as well? We can try to implement maybe soccer fields or some of the other things that are popular?
It's a full package. You know, it's going to be for lacrosse, baseball.
And lacrosse is growing.
Flag football is another large... league in the town that I'm lucky enough to coach. He's done a great job. He's put lots of money into new sidewalks, new roads that hadn't been done in the past. The parking lot in South Weymouth looked like downtown Beirut. It was absolutely potholes. Mm. And he called over to NSTAR, or the people at Union Point, LSTAR, I should say, and they forwarded the money, and he got a fix prior to when it was supposed to be fixed. So I want to help with his proactive approach and just continue with, you know, the good stuff that he's been doing in town since he's been elected.
Thoughts on economic development? That's always a key when you're moving forward in your growing community or municipality. Your thoughts on it?
The big economic development of the town of Weymouth, obviously, is whatever happens with Union Point. The anchor of Union Point is getting ready to start, which would be ProDrive, which would be a robotic industry business. And hopefully that will be the anchor that will bring in more businesses into our community, because the more businesses we have in the community, obviously the better our tax base is, which helps us, you know, in the end. So that, to make sure that Union Point is going forward, is huge for economic development in the town.
Joe?
What is the plan right now with Union Point in terms of, is there a bunch of additional housing going in there? Do you know yet?
There is. They changed the legislation so they could add more housing. They were supposed to...
Did they rezone it, so to speak?
They didn't rezone it, but they were allowed to build so much housing, and then they were supposed to build so many square footage of commercial. Okay. And they gave them the opportunity to continue building the housing, because they claimed that they were having trouble getting the business in there. But now with ProDrive in there, hopefully that's going to be the anchor to move it all forward.
And what's a quick update too? I know there's a lot going on in the landing as well. That's that area. I avoid it now, but I know it will be good because it's crazy.
The Delagas property, as far as I know, will be starting real soon.
Great.
That's another property that sat there for years.
Yeah.
Nobody could make any movement with it. You know, and kudos to the mayor. He came in and he got all the parties. He got the church. He got the district councilor, everybody sat down, and they came up with a plan that worked for everybody. Huh. So that's moving forward.
If you're elected, I mean, how do you feel that you would complement what the mayor is trying to accomplish?
Well, he's very proactive, and hopefully with some of the ideas that I have, you know, I can help. Obviously, I'm not going to agree with everything that he does. You know, I am my own person. One of the things that I am proud of during this campaign is that I've received many union endorsements. I've been endorsed by the Weymouth Fire Department. I've been endorsed by the Norfolk County Labor Council, Plymouth County, the Tin Knockers, who my brother is actually a member of, the Iron Workers. So those would be, you know, groups that might be considered more Democrat, where the mayor's Republican. So those might be issues that we would differ on. But, you know, I'd have to take each issue up as it is and see where we stand.
been speaking with Fred Happel. He is running for at large, council at large in Weymouth. Folks want to find out more about you, whether it's social media, website, whatever. How can they do that?
Sure. I have a Facebook page, which is... Actually, let me give you my my Gmail is happelforweymouth@gmail.com.
Spell that.
H-A-P-P-E-L for Weymouth at gmail.com. So you can send me an email there. Fred Happel, Counselor at Large. I do have a Facebook site. And I also have a P.O. box if someone needed to send a letter to me, which is P.O. box 535 South Weymouth, Mass. 02190.
Position you played when you were playing baseball?
Outfield. I was a center fielder.
Oh, okay. Okay. Favorite baseball player now?
Well, my favorite baseball player was Fred Lynn. Now...
Wow, number 19. All right.
Well, he was center fielder. He was a lefty, which I was a lefty, yeah. And I grew up
big
in that
mistake
era.
Leaving Boston.
Yeah, it ruined his career.
See,
except for the All-Star game that he hit a grand slam.
True. Good
that
point.
That was a big moment.
Knowing that the mayor is listening, it would probably want me to ask you a couple of baseball questions because that was his, you know, he wanted to take the conversation in different directions. And knowing that he's a guy who is he's probably like a celebrity softball player now. So, who knows what league he's playing in tonight? He's probably out somewhere, hitting him deep somewhere. So, Fred, I want to thank you for coming in, and we wish you the best of luck, as we wish all the candidates. And if there are candidates that are in this race or any race that are coming up, we know the city of Brockton, they're going to be having city elections coming up in September and November. Feel free to reach out to myself. Do it on Twitter at Kevin Tocci, T-O-C-C-I, or you can send me an email to mondaynighttalk@gmail.com, my friend.
Thank you very much for
having me. Again, the invitation is there for you to stay for Joe's segment and also for the Dr. Birnbaum segment as well. If not, well, then we'll definitely catch up with you on the other side. We are going to step aside just for a moment. And when we come back, we're going to talk flood insurance with the one and the only Joe Rossi. Don't go anywhere.
This is Monday Night Talk with your host, Kevin Tocci, on 95.9 WATD.
Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, welcome opening day, Pembroke Titans softball.
Okay, Addie, you got this. Just relax.
I know, Dad.
First batter coming to the plate.
I know, Hattie, but just keep your eye on the ball. Just keep your eye on the ball.
Dad, relax. I do got this.
I know, Hattie. Remember, don't swing at the first pitch.
Daddy!
And here's the pitch. That is a fair... In fact, that's a home run!
Sorry about your windshield, Dad.
Are you kidding me? That was awesome. I'm keeping the inspection sticker for a souvenir.
Windshield broken by a home run? Call Tiny first. 1-888-64-TINYS.
That's my Hattie.
Welcome back to Monday Night Talk. Don't just listen, say something. Call 781-837-4900. And now, more Monday Night Talk with your host, Kevin Tocci.
All right, time for my co-host to switch hats and talk a little flood insurance. We know that the renewal for this for the National Flood Insurance Program, that's coming up in September, right, Joe?
The National Flood Insurance Program expires on September 30th of this year. That's it.
So what's being done? Is it at least close to the finish line, or?
Sure. So, yeah. Well, you know, I'd love it to have been at the finish line by now, especially since really Congress goes on recess very soon, and then we're stuck with coming back into full session at the end of August, early September, and we've got less than 30 days at that point if nothing happens between now and then to reauthorize the program. A lot of talk about such little time. What I'm going to do is give an overview of the current legislative state of the program,
okay,
and give a reason why people should care. So right now there are three bills that are overall three bills. There's technically about seven or eight, but several of those are going to have to be packaged into one bill. So I'm going to give an overview of the bills that are out there. So what's happening right now is the program expires September 30th. If Congress does not renew the program by September 30th, then the program expires, and until it is renewed, nobody will be able to purchase flood insurance from the federal government, and no existing policies will be able to renew from the federal government. So it's a big deal. So what's happened is the House, actually, the U.S. House of Representatives, has surprisingly made this a priority. We know of all the things that are going on in Congress, we were really worried that this would not be a priority for them. We've got health care, we've got tax reform, we've got all these other things going on. So about a month and a half ago, at the end of April, early May, the House came out, U.S. House of Representatives, which this bill falls under their Financial Services Committee, came out with a bill called the 21st Century Flood Reform Bill. This bill did some really good things. It caps premiums for, we think, residential structures, although it's kind of vague at this point. Increases the availability of insurance should you have a total loss. It actually increases the amount of money that goes towards the buildings that need to be corrected after a loss, elevated and made so that they don't have another loss. And also does some other administrative things, which is supposed to make the program more financially sound, which is what everybody wants, even those that are trying to make the program affordable. However, what this bill does do is some extremely detrimental things. We remember in 2012, those involved in most of the nation at the time, the getting rid of grandfathering, or the immediate triggers and sunsetting of the grandfathering, quote-unquote, provisions, which basically means if you're receiving favorable rates, that over time those rates would start to go away extremely quickly. I think a four-year phase-out under the old act, the Biggert-Waters Act, and then you would be at full risk rates. So this bill reinstates that phase out. Very concerning, because we're worried that, yes, do we want to eventually move to the actual rates that people should be receiving? Over time, yes, because we want the rates to be sufficient for the program. The problem is we don't want a four-year phase out. That would create the problems we saw 5 years ago. So that's one thing that this bill does. The other thing that it does, too, is it actually does something very interesting. You know, each bill that we talk about today, its goal is to allow the private program in even more, which isn't a bad thing. But what the House bill says basically is, we're going to not allow any new buildings built in a flood zone to get any type of federal insurance, any federal flood insurance.
And everybody else is grandfathered, right?
Everybody else is grandfathered. They phase out under the four-year phase out, because they work hand in hand. But those that are in the flood zone now, that are built new in the flood zone, cannot get federal flood insurance. Well, the problem with that is that when you adopt maps in a community, you don't just adopt the maps, you adopt a set of building codes and standards that make buildings in flood zones, in some cases, built stronger and better than buildings not in a flood zone. So now you're taking away the best buildings that the program should be writing, and you're giving them away to the private program. So that's something we're opposed to. Then very quickly in the Senate, you've got two bills. Oh, so the House bill, that was called the 21st Century House Flood Reform. The Congress broke that bill up into about five different bills. Each bill went through committee with absolutely very few amendments attached to them, even though there were members of the House that wanted things removed and added, but the leadership in the House didn't want that to happen. So the House bill came out very similar to the way it went in, except it's split up into five different bills. Those will have to be reconsolidated into one bill. That's why I'm saying there's a couple bills.
Okay.
They moved out of committee. And in fact, there's word that within the next week or so, those bills could be voted on by a full body of the House. So that's what's going on in the U.S. House of Representatives. Well, more constructively in the Senate, however, we have two bills. The Cassidy-Gillibrand bill in the Senate and the NFIP SAFE Act in the Senate. Now, the great thing about the SAFE Act, which is a little bit too comprehensive, these two bills are too comprehensive to go into. Right now, they're only in committee. But the SAFE Act is co-sponsored by Senator Elizabeth Warren, which is great for us because we've already met with her staff to give inputs and comments on that piece of legislation. And it does a lot of good things. It actually caps the annual increase on flood policies to 10% a year, which is perfect. Gives us a long phase out of those rates, doesn't create the four-year immediate phase out, makes things affordable, does a lot of good things. So that's a real brief overview of what's going on right now. We know it's a priority for Congress. We know they're working on it. There's things that need to be changed, but there's bills that are proposed right now.
So give us the best case scenario in regards to the House, what the House is working on,
sure,
and what the Senate is working on. And I guess the one thing I would ask is if there is some kind of, if these are not voted on and passed, is there a way for to seek an extension before this expires?
Yeah, there's actually word that a one-year extension is being floated around right now, that we may say, hey, there's so much good work going on, we don't want to rush it into a final bill.
Right.
So we get a year-long extension, let's work on it next year. That is a possibility. Should that not happen, then the best case scenario is that the House votes in a bill with or without the attachments that we don't like. They would then go to the Senate and work to consolidate the bills into one overall good bill that takes the good things from the Senate and the good things from the House, makes it a solid bill that gets passed through both sides. That's the ideal world. Mm. And the ideal world would be that it gets reauthorized for 10 years, which is what we're looking for to create stability. Only the Cassidy-Gillibrand bill in the Senate is a 10-year bill. Although the NFIP SAFE Act, the one that Elizabeth Warren is on, that has a 6-year reauthorization. So that is a solid bill reauthorization. It's a compromise. So what we're hoping is for a 10-year reauthorization, something that preserves grandfathering, something that strengthens the private programs entrance into the flood program, into the availability, and something that increases the amount of money that goes to fix buildings that are damaged, because those are the ones that cause the most burden to the program.
Okay, we're speaking with Joe Rossi, chair of the Marshfield Citizens Coastal Coalition, also a gentleman who sits on a couple of national boards, somebody who is, he's kind of like the godfather of flood insurance around here. That's what I would call him. He knows his stuff. He knows it inside and out. He specializes in it. It's nice to hear that at least some of the legislative delegation down in Washington is doing something, at least on the Senate side. When there was a meeting with Senator Warren, was there any indication that there was growing support for what was being worked on, or sure, was she still working in that area?
So we met with staffers from Senator Elizabeth Warren's office, Congressman Keating's office, and Congressman Lynch's office, and I have to give credit to where it's due. We had great cooperation from several major stakeholders, the biggest of which was the South Shore Chamber of Commerce, who helped coordinate this meeting with us. And really, we've actually drafted a 6-page letter that has gone to Congress now as a response to the meeting with them. And really, the taste of the meeting essentially was, the House is going to move forward the way that they're going to move. Let's focus on the Senate. Let's focus on, you know, working with Elizabeth Warren's office, at least locally, and let's work there, because it looks like the House has chosen a direction to go in and will be moving that way. So Senator Warren is actually working extremely bipartisanly on this bill. There's Senator Cassidy from Louisiana is co-sponsoring this. Senator Rubio is co-sponsoring this. Menendez, and Warren, and there's one or two others. So that bill, the NFIP, and that's the NFIP SAFE Act, really, I think, has the most hope from a sustainability, affordability, and cooperative-wise, you know, standpoint. That really is a strong bill. Our overall comments to Congress is basically reflected almost entirely in that bill, which is, you know, we need more mitigation, we need more funding for mapping, we need the program to be affordable, we need to reduce our administrative costs, and we need more private participation.
What's the thoughts as to our Commander-in-Chief? This is an unconventional political figure. Isn't somebody who does things as you may expect, whether it was someone with a D or an R next to the name. has there been any conversation when in regards to this area to Donald Trump?
Well, our biggest concern right now is what he's already done, which is slash the funding for mapping and also proposed an added fee on existing policies for mapping. And there's two problems here. With the added fee, when more private policy policies are allowed to be entered into the program, which, as I mentioned, every single bill allows that to happen, naturally the amount of policies in the National Flood Program will drop. It's just going to happen. That doesn't mean less people are getting covered by flood. It just means they're going to outside markets, which is fine because we'll take a dip and build the new book of business for the NFIP over time. But what that does mean is that those left in the program will be saddled with more fees to fund the mapping, which some of these bills actually ask private policies to contribute a fee, which we support as well. It's called an equivalency fee to do that. But that is a concern. The second thing is mapping, which people around the South Shore aren't fond of FEMA's mapping, but one of the main reasons we got what we'll call poor mapping is FEMA cited the lack of funding for their mapping program. So what the president's budget has done is slash the mapping program in half. So we go from a $400 million a year mapping budget to a $190 million a year mapping budget. FEMA has essentially said what that will do is allow a maintenance-only program with no new mapping. What's so bad about that? Well, 3 million stream miles of rivers have not been mapped at all by the flood program. So what you have is a program that has not entirely mapped the country. So our recommendation to Congress is, regardless of the mapping funding, focus on those areas that haven't been mapped yet rather than redoing areas that we know are at least mapped somewhat. But then to also reinstate that funding to at least $400 to $500 million a year to try to do some of that mapping. You know, if FEMA was properly funded, I'm almost certain we wouldn't have gone through the pains our region went through when we went through that mapping process. So poor mapping funding, as much as we don't like the mapping, equals good maps. So we need to keep that in mind.
Time for you to pay off on your tees. You had mentioned that there's a speaking engagement or there's going to be some kind of a gathering in Montana for regarding flood insurance.
So I, you know,
Please explain.
I'm very fortunate to be recognized at the national level as an expert in not just flood insurance, but all the components that go with it. And I was just talking to somebody today about this is while I know the program extremely well, I also know the people involved really well, the why things happen the way that they do and really getting involved in the way things are forming in Congress. I was asked to speak at a national conference that's happening in Kalispell, Montana, which is actually way up near Glacier National Park. Now, for those that aren't familiar with the way the flood program works, every national flood policy trickles down into basically seven companies that do all the processing work for the federal government. Two of those companies are in the same community way up in nowhere, Montana. And the story behind that is actually funny. The biggest processing company, which started there for reasons that go back many years, the founder of the other processing company left the one that was already in Montana, decided not to leave there since she lived there, and established the second flood processing company. So out of seven flood processing companies, two of them are in the same community in the middle of Montana. So it's actually quite interesting. Doesn't have much to do with the flooding or not flooding. It has more to do with the locations of those that started businesses and are now processing most of the flood policies in the country. So it's a great opportunity for me. I'll be speaking at the Torrent Summer Session, which is a big flood processing company who really recognized my expertise in the program. And they're actually having me speak on an interesting topic. I'll be speaking on what we think as an agent, as the industry in general, what we think FEMA will be able to do about the shrinking number of policies in the program. So we already know that from 2013-14 to today, we've lost almost more than 500,000 policies in the program. So FEMA has said that by 2023, they want to double the amount of policies, not just in the NFIP, but in the private industry as well. Do we think it will happen by 2023? That's what I'm going to be speaking about. So it's a great opportunity, and I really appreciate those that have invited me to speak.
Tickets still available? Plane tickets?
I booked mine already. It's not a cheap flight. It's not a short flight. So it should be fun, though. It's once in a lifetime opportunity, and I'm very happy to be able to go out there. We actually have private meetings with FEMA leadership during that conference, so I'm hoping to be able to directly communicate with them some of the issues we've had to try to bring home, not necessarily answers, but at least better communication and discussion about not just mapping issues, but also insurance in general. You know, working with those people hand in hand, the people not just at FEMA, but in the industry, is critical. So I know it's almost my time so I'm going to give the website for people to find out more. MarshfieldCoastalCoalition.org. There on our homepage, you can sign on to the letter we've sent to Congress. We're going to be sending them a signed version with everybody's signature. Please go there. Sign up for our emails, our newsletters. Right now, we're sending one out about every 2 weeks since so much is happening in Congress. So that's it. We also give great advice, and there's a lot going on with the coalition. That will be for another show. We're actually moving to become a nonprofit. So I'm very happy and pleased to announce that as well.
As there are details, of course, listen to 95.9 WATD, whether it's the South Shore's Morning News, or if you're listening to Monday Night Talk, or who knows.
Kevin, we need about 2 more hours, and I can fit everything in.
Yeah, I know. We'll have to do it in little bites.
Sure.
Little bites. We don't want to overwhelm people with a program of that magnitude, but we are going to step aside, and when we come back, hour number 2 of Monday Night Talk right here on 95.9 WATD. Don't go anywhere.
The South Shore's breaking news, weather, and traffic station.
95.9 WATD FM Marshfield and 95.9 WATD.com. This is Monday Night Talk with your host, Kevin Tachi, on 95.9 WATD.
Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, welcome opening day, Pembroke Titans softball.
Okay, Addie, you got this. Just relax.
I know, Dad.
First batter coming to the plate.
I know, Hattie, but just keep your eye on the ball. Just keep your eye on the ball.
Dad, relax. I do got this.
I know, Hattie. Remember, don't swing at the first pitch.
Daddy!
And here's the pitch. That is a fair... In fact, that's a home run!
Sorry about your windshield, Dad.
Are you kidding me? That was awesome. I'm keeping the inspection sticker for a souvenir.
Windshield broken by a home run? Call Tiny first. 1-888-64-TINYS.
That's my Hattie.
Be a part of the show. Call and join in on the conversation. 781-837-4900. Now, back to Monday Night Talk.
All right, so we're back for the second hour. We got a pleasant surprise initially. Now, there's a couple of gentlemen that I deal with to look for guests to talk on topics, experts like you, Joe, when it comes to flood insurance.
Oh, thank you.
And so I was looking to speak with our next guest, but was given who I promoted earlier, Dr. Frieda Birnbaum. So during the stop set, he stopped in and chatted with Larry. And Larry's like, oh, Dr. Huber's on the line. I go, you're kidding. Really? So joining us right now is Dr. John Huber. And he's here to talk to us a little bit about a new CBS poll. And this is in regards to how Americans feel in regards to the current state of politics. And is it encouraging violence? So we're speaking with Dr. Huber. Welcome back to the program, sir.
Well, thank you for having me on.
By mistake. I, as I told you on the line, I initially had reached out to Ryan last week and said, I'd love to have him because he was, you know, I'll get regular emails. Hey, this individual could talk about this and talk about that. I'm like, can I have John? And then instead I had Dr. Frieda's information sent to me. I'm like, okay, John's unavailable. I'll take Dr. Frieda. But it serves the same purpose. And that is to talk about this poll, which is very intriguing. I'm looking at this CBS story that they have. Americans of all political leanings are overwhelmingly saying that the tone and level of civility when it comes to our political debates is getting worse in recent years. Do you agree or disagree with that?
Well, the tone in the politics is, I believe, getting worse, and part of it is because of this social media thing where anybody can say anything.
Oh my God!
So, you know, if you go and look at Loretta Lynch and she's saying blood in the streets, well, you go back and actually look at the transcript of what she said, she didn't say that. She started talking about historical, you know, blood in the streets back, you know, when we were becoming a country after the 13 colonies. But the media twists it, the social media twists it, and people are use it to wind other people up. So it can be pretty devastating.
And so I just want to also make sure I give you the proper information about the good doctor, who is Texas-based and can be found at mainstreammentalhealth.org. Is that correct?
Yes, sir.
All right. Clinical forensic psychologist. It's interesting that you mentioned the first thing out of the box, you talk about social media, because myself these days, I do engage in social media only as a marketing tool to let folks know what we're doing in this program, or if I'm working on a news story and put it out there. Other than that, it's a matter of watching, you know, individuals say whatever they will, regardless of how the person is going to feel, because they're not standing there in front of them. It's interesting, don't you think?
I think it is on a lot of levels, and as people, especially generations that are coming up behind us, they do their socialization that way. And it's interesting watching groups of high school students interact, where the cafeteria used to be the noisiest place in the whole school, and now you can actually hold a conversation in there because there's hardly any noise.
So I would ask you this, is, you know, looking back to last year when we had the presidential campaign for office, we were seeing the two, you know, the two individuals representing their parties, the nominees, and it seemed as though there was no boundaries. Are Americans kind of taking that as maybe that's how they should conduct themselves?
Well, I think that's kind of what's happening. I mean, even go look at what was her name, Michelle Carter, who encouraged her boyfriend to get back in the truck while he was trying to kill himself. Mm. So he ended up dying, you know, and she got manslaughter for that, you know, 10 days ago.
That happened right here in Massachusetts. What's your thought about somebody being convicted for telling an individual to go ahead, kill yourself?
Well, I think the manslaughter is inappropriate. I'll tell you why it is appropriate, is because she knew exactly where he was. He was within a half a mile, I believe it was, of a police station, and within a couple of miles of family. And, you know, as a mental health provider, I have a legal obligation. If I know somebody is trying to commit, you know, suicide or harm themselves, I have to notify the authorities. And the law says that if an everyday citizen knows somebody's doing it, they have an obligation too, and she chose not to call 911. Mm. With all the harassment she gave him, we've had multiple cases where bullies have bullied teenagers and stuff into committing suicide, but not while they were actively engaged in it. She knew he was actively engaged, and she chose not to notify any authority.
Let's talk a little bit more about the poll. And I want to get your thoughts in regards to the collective mental state of Americans. How on point is this poll? Is it, as every poll is there is some gray area and you can't totally rely on it, or do you feel that it's somewhat accurate?
Well, you know, it's kind of unusual because it's pretty evenly distributed among all the different parties out there,
right?
The left, the right, and the independents. So I'm actually inclined to believe that it's pretty accurate. And with the people I talk with, it's definitely accurate.
What can be done to improve this state of Americans when it comes to politics? Is there? I mean, there's no quick fix. We know that.
No.
But what? So we agree on that. So what can be done? What can turn this thing around?
Well, I think where we can do some good is, you know, regardless of whether you believe in mainstream media or not anymore, which a lot of society is, you know, complaining fake this, fake that, and it just confuses everything. I think that the mainstream media is very powerful, and still it can be very powerful. And if they step up to the plate and do things like you're doing, bring in people who practice mental health issues and talk about, okay, this is what they're saying, but it's a rhetorical comment. And, you know, if you know, essentially, if you know somebody is actually making plans, do something about it. Don't just sit there and go, oh, yeah, right, he's not going to do that.
Well, I think a lot of people would say that leadership starts at the top. We look at our current commander-in-chief. I mean, this is an individual that some of the times, if you read what he does on social media, what he does on Twitter, you ask yourself, where is he at mentally? Do you ever ask yourself that as a professional? Where is our, you know, president at mentally?
Well, I believe that there's a, what is it, the Goldwater rule or something. I'm not allowed to make a comment about a sitting president's mental health. You know, I haven't evaluated him. And I can't say that anybody, you know, has a certain thing unless I actually evaluate them technically. But, you know, he, look at what he did. He knows how to draw attention to himself. And he says absurd things. He has since the 70s. I mean, this is not a guy who's fresh on the media scene. And he spent roughly, what 12% of what the Democrats spent, and yet he was able to win because he was able to get his voice out there. As a population, we have about a three-month memory about what people say as far as the media is concerned. So as long as he gets himself out there, he stays in people's memory. But when it came time to voting, they couldn't remember necessarily why they were remembering him from last March.
We look back just days ago when that we had an individual who went down to where congressional folks who were practicing baseball and decided to open fire. Luckily, there were individuals who were then able to return fire and ultimately take his life. We look at when a person acts out violently like that because of their reaction to a political matter, what does that reveal about them psychologically?
Well, in this case, typically when you look at mental health issues, individuals suffering from that are actually statistically less likely to act out in a harmful way against other people. They're more concerned about being harmed by other people. However, there are rare exceptions, and all the dominoes kind of lined up with him. He was upset. He was a big Bernie Sanders volunteer and supporter, and he felt like if you were able to get to see his website, he was posting on Facebook about being upset that they stole a denomination from him, the Democratic Party, and then he turned over. He was a member of Exterminate All Republicans, I believe is the name of the Facebook page.
Yep.
But he has a key thing that people tend to forget. He has a past history of violence. He has many charges against him through foster care. And his own child had Child Protective Services come in and investigate because he pulled a chunk of her hair out. And then he had a history with using guns to intimidate people. In fact, there were a couple of charges against him shooting at objects next to people to get them to comply to him. And they were eventually dropped. But the problem is the way behavior escalates until you take it all the way to the max, that's how far you'll go. And when I do risk assessments for the county courthouse and the local, some of the other outside counties from where I live, you know, we have to look at the whole picture of the person. And this individual was severely depressed. He lost his business due to what he felt like was a government regulation because he wasn't able to renew his license and his business was gone. He was 66 and he felt like his life was over and he had nothing better do than to make his mark on history, and I think he took that opportunity. And he was very calm, according to the people who saw him in the parking lot. He knew what he was doing. It was a pretty scary thing, actually.
Again, we're speaking with Dr. John Huber. He's here to talk to us in regards to trying to restore civility when it comes to politics. Doctor, joining me is my co-host. He hasn't said anything yet, but I think he's got a question forming. Mr. Joe Rossi. Joe, do you have a question?
Well, Kevin, you're just stealing the show. That's why.
Is that what I'm doing?
Are these, you know, I mean, we just talking about the shooting that happened, you know, and there's only been one congressman ever actually shot and killed while sitting in
office.
In office. Yeah. Do you expect, you know, based on how things have gone in the last several years, trending and kind of the escalation of these things, I mean, is this something that where congressmen are going to have to start having these types of details more and more often?
I would wager to say that right now, much more or many more of our congressmen actually do. I don't know exactly, but
sure.
If I was a congressman, I definitely something I would have probably already gotten taken care of by this point. But, you know, things come in ebbs and flows, you know. So as we swing one way and we swing back the other, go back historically. I mean, there was a, you know, starting with Jack Kennedy and going through the early 70s, we had a lot of assassination attempts.
Yeah.
And people were successful. Then it kind of stopped. And then we had somebody going after Reagan in the early 80s, but we didn't have a rush of repeat things. So... it's kind of like waves, and you know, right now we haven't had any copycats that we're aware of as a public. So my assumption is that again, this wasn't a terrorist situation. This was a man who was on. He had a vendetta, and he wanted to make things even. And he knew it was a one-way street. He wasn't coming back. So. I don't think we're going to see a lot of repeats, I hope, anyway.
Well, what are some of the ways that you feel that Americans can return to civil discussions when it comes to politics? And that is on all levels, but it seems mostly on the national level.
Right. Well, one of the things is when we comment and we start, you know, because we can't get away from the social media stuff. You know, when you're replying... If you can't say anything but calling people names, which that escalates everything, you know, use your rational mind. Don't drop into your emotional mind. And that's, you know, that's a big trigger. You start getting everybody upset. So it's just like when I tell my couples who are trying to work through things, don't communicate with each other unless you both can communicate in a normal tone of voice. You know, and it may take time, but you just got to take that time. And it's the same way with the name calling and using caps and trying to spam people. And it's they're triggers, and it just they're there to escalate people. And people have access to it, and they get you to buy into it, and all of a sudden they have power over you. Don't give that up.
Does it seem to you as though that these individuals who look to, you know, take a stand and will do it at all cost, that it's an act of desperation, or that they feel that as though, you know, that's, you know, they're going to be less than a person if they agree with somebody on a stance on a political item?
Well, I think if you know, I think you were dealing with two different things. People who are actually going out, like the shooter at the baseball, that is an act of desperation. And then people who have to fire back to escalate the conversation, exactly. They think somehow they appear to be weak or somehow you know, less of a human being if they don't fight back with those people. Whereas if they were face to face, they'd have never escalated it in the first place.
See, and that's the thing that I always think about when it comes to social media. A lot of people, their behavior is starkly, it's different than if they were in person. They wouldn't say or do half those things, but where you're who knows how many miles away from an individual and you're able to say anything and know that there's no actual and direct consequences.
Well, Kevin, you remember a few years ago when the newspapers used to have terrible comments being made on their threads.
Right, in the local area,
and
yeah.
And they got rid of the anonymity of the people that were posting. You had to actually put your name
yep.
there, and I'm almost certain... That stops sense.
Actually,
wow.
he's doctor. He's correct. Is a lot of our local newspapers did you were able to have an alias, so to speak, even multiple aliases. And I know individuals who would have fake accounts, so they would be able to, you know, attack an individual from multiple accounts just so
That's
they can
crazy.
Feel victorious. But people do that. people do that.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. I mean, I've met a lot of people, and I have a lot of people on my personal Facebook page, and I have a couple people who actually, you know, they're very rational individuals, but they know that if they say the right thing, there's going to be a chain on my Facebook page for the next 3 days. So they don't even believe what they're saying. They're just doing it to get everybody ticked off.
Right.
And I've had to talk to them and say, look, stop this. You know, it's like I'm out in public and people think I'm supporting you when I don't shut you down. I try to stay out of all that stuff, and it's crazy. So he's pretty much stopped most of that.
Are you a reality TV guy?
I'm not a very big TV guy at all. I mean, okay. I'm everywhere. I don't have a lot of time to sit down, and when I do, it's I sit down with my family and we do Game of Thrones. So
well,
that's pretty much it.
I preface that comment with, I mean, it's so much so the way things are in social media. Is there's a TV show called Catfish.
Really?
Yes, and it was actually born out of a documentary of an individual who his brother followed him as he was trying to meet this woman who he had a relationship with, but they had never seen each other, and there was a strange behavior in whenever he would try to call her on the phone or try to do video chat. And so what ended up happening was he ended up going down there because a camera crew followed him down to meet up with this individual person who eventually they learned that that person was a figment of a woman's imagination who was married, who had children. But it was one of those things that she played with this individual. And so it spawned this TV show where individuals have a suspicion about somebody that they have been interacting with in such a manner on social media, but are suspicious, and they call these two people in, and they actually try to find out if this person is authentic, if it's somebody who is just using a fake account, and who the real person is behind the account. And it's in its fifth season. So when we sit here and we talk about people using social media as a means to be someone that they aren't or try to be another individual, I almost kind of think it's a sickness.
You know, and it'll be interesting because, you know, we have addictions and stuff on social media. I mean, true addiction.
Yep.
And as we evolve in mental health, I would not be surprised if there are not new diagnoses that we have out there for this type of behavior.
Knowing that this is, you know, this is your field. I mean, looking at what's going on, the conversation to replace Obamacare, give me your thoughts. I mean, especially when we're talking about trying to take care of mental health and folks who need to seek help. What's your thoughts on what's going on right now with trying to have a second version of affordable care?
Well, that's what I think is happening, is we're trying to create a second version. And, you know, it's kind of overwhelming. I go back to the early 70s when everybody just started cutting mental health care, and we shut down our state mental health facilities and went to community mental health, and then people are living on the streets, and we've never gotten any better, and it seems like every year we just lose more and more and more. The fact that it's even being brought up now, I think, is a benefit, but, you know, there's no telling what's going to happen. I'm not optimistic, if that's an appropriate way to put it. You know, I didn't like what happened with the first ACA, and I don't think it's going to get any better with the second.
So what do we do in order to help Americans who have mental health issues and can't afford to get that help? I mean, I'm asking you as someone who, this is your profession, and, you know, somebody who, you know, is on the ground level, seeing this on
right.
a regular basis.
Well, you know, with version one, what I found out when the patients come into my practice with the affordable care insurance, they have a second deductible, a behavioral health deductible, and the cheapest one I've seen through my door was about $6,000, so my patients couldn't afford to see me because they couldn't afford the $6,000, but if they could have just paid the copay, it would have been great. What I've done, actually, in complaining with all my physicians I work with, it's the reason why I started my nonprofit, is to, A, try and destigmatize through education, being out there talking and putting myself, making myself vulnerable, because I'm human and I do potentially make mistakes. But the second one is we're actually starting a fundraising campaign here in July to start creating a fund base for our veterans to start being able to pay for them outpatient therapy, not medication, not inpatient in hospitalization, but outpatient therapy. And then our third phase is we would do it for individuals who can't afford therapy under the age of 26 and start at that point. But right now we're getting ready to start phase two. And if you look at the veterans, if they go to the VA, it's a 132-day wait on average for them to get in to see a therapist after they ask for it.
Wow. Crazy.
And it's crazy. In fact, I got a call a week ago Friday from a veteran in Georgia, and he was all excited. He was going to go see his therapist, and it was only 30 days out. And I was like, wow, that's amazing. You know, it's normally 130 days or more. And he goes, no, you don't understand. I scheduled this 12 months ago, so it's actually 13 months for me to get in to see my therapist.
Wow. That's crazy. Well,
so I'm trying to do it. I'm trying to figure out a solution on my own, and that's why, you know, starting a nonprofit and trying to create a fund for that.
Well, again, we know you from being the chair of that nonprofit. We know that you've been a mental health professional for over 20 years, but we also didn't mention the fact that you're a professor and a teacher at Texas State University, correct?
Yes. However, the demands of this nonprofit, it looks like this summer may be it for me. I've got some discussions to have with my department chair and the dean and the funders who are funding my nonprofit at this point. So
see,
that may be running out.
See, I was going to say that, you know, this could, I was wondering if this would somehow matriculate its way onto your syllabus for next fall. And it could be a topic of conversation during one of the classes in regards to, you know, this new poll.
Well, you know, actually this summer, it's actually come up several times this summer. And my students are concerned. I mean, it's actually nice to see real concern out of a generation that's had their face stuck in tablets and phones and computer screens, so.
Well, we wish you the best of luck. We look forward to having you back on yet again. And again, thank you very much for being our pleasant surprise. No disrespect to Dr. Frieda, but I was equally happy to hear that you were going to be our guest, and I was thoroughly fulfilled with this conversation.
Well, honestly, I pushed my martial arts back an hour, so I'm getting ready to go break some boards. So thank you.
All right.
I appreciate the opportunity to be there.
All right. There he is. Dr. John Huber, our guest for this segment of Monday Night Talk. Doctor, have a good evening.
Thank you, Kevin.
You got it. All right. We are going to take a quick break here, if it's okay with you, Larry, because I'm feeling a need to stick the key in the ignition, get Junior D'Amato on the airline. We'll be back in just a moment here on Monday Night Talk. Don't go anywhere.
Is Monday Night Talk with your host, Kevin Tachi, on 95.9 WATD.
Back in the 1950s, Grossman's in Braintree had sitting out in front of their lot a gigantic pile of intertwined wire cable. Neighborhood kids told one another it was an anti-submarine net used during World War II, maybe the one at Pearl Harbor. Kids used to climb all over it, very dangerous. Bill Buckley even took home a clip from it. He left it on his front porch and then forgot all about it. That was the summer of 1958. 40 years later, Bill was mowing his parents' lawn, a favor he enjoyed. Suddenly, the mower blade struck that clip and sent it smashing through his own windshield. When he picked it up from the front seat, he had no clue.
I'm Tiny of Tiny & Sons Glass. We come to your work or home and we fix your windshield. Your insurance covers it. We're Tiny and Sons. My boys do a good job. 1-888-64-TINIES. Just call.
Find Monday Night Talk on Facebook and share your opinions. Go to 959WATD.com/Monday Night Talk.
Welcome back to Monday Night Talk here on 959 WATD, heard worldwide 959WATD.com. Joining us is the one and only Monday Night Talk auto expert. I like to call him that, even though he is known globally as he does write a regular column, or at least I see it on a regular basis. None other than Mr. Junior D'Amato. Junior, welcome back to Monday Night Talk, my friend.
Mr. Kevin, how are you?
And I'm not alone, as Mopar Joe is in the room.
Oh, boy.
Yeah, and he's, I got to tell you, he is, let's not talk about it till I don't know, about 15, 20 minutes, but Joe is in the market for an automobile or a new vehicle.
Potentially.
So some of the vehicles that you've been driving, when we talk about it later on in the segment, Joe will be definitely listening with both ears.
Well, I tell you, I have a car for Joe and for everybody out there that travels on the road, and it's something that you would never even think about. And I had no idea until I drove it, and it was a fabulous car. It was a Hyundai Ioniq, I guess they call it.
Really?
I got to tell you, my goodness gracious, it's a real car that's a hybrid. And no matter how I abused it, I still got 53 miles a gallon with it.
Wow.
And I was amazed. I did drive it most of the time in the sport mode because it really gave me a big, big, big power increase. And I'm going to write about the car tonight. And tonight I drove home a new Lincoln Continental.
Oh, how was that?
A big, beautiful car with massaging seats, seats that do everything but say Gesundheit when you sleep. I had a car last week that I really wasn't happy with, a Fiata.
That's a mix, right?
You ever hear of a Fiata?
Isn't that a mix between two car companies?
Yeah. a Fix-It Again Tony.
Yep.
And a Miata from Mazda.
Yep.
So I tell you, if I had some time and it was my car, I would have had to lift the back of the seat up probably about two to three inches. That way, when you sat down, you didn't actually fall down into it.
Mm.
What a complaint. I mean, but other than that, the car was a fun car to drive. Well, I was really disappointed with the seating in it.
But do you feel,
I call it my Fiata.
But I have to ask you, though, Junior, do you feel that they're marketing it towards a certain demographic? I mean, a lot of vehicles, I kind of feel that they're being built and they're being touted out. They're like the revamping of the muscle cars that we knew from the 60s, 70s, and early 80s.
The problem is that when you fall into the car, even a teenager doesn't want to fall into a
true
car. And, you know, the car is really great, and that's something that can be adjusted without a big deal. But, I mean, that's just my own personal preference. And, you know, we do tell you like it is when it comes to these cars, and maybe that's why they keep throwing cars at me every week, because they enjoy it.
How was the Lincoln Continental, quite honestly, is one of my favorite cars out there right now. What was your thought about that vehicle? I've had a chance to sit in one and really look at one that's really trimmed out. What was your thoughts on that?
The one I have is silver with a black gut, and it's got a $70,000 price tag. It's got, I think, about $12,000 or $13,000 in options, which brings it up to the dollar amount. But it's got a $1,500, I believe. I don't have the sticker price in front of me, but I think the optional engine that's in it was about $1,500, and it's got lots of power. And it just is a really nice car. It doesn't have that alien grill in the front anymore.
Mm.
They had the most hideous grill many, many years on the front of those Lincolns. And it's really a nice grill. It's maybe a little bit looking like maybe a Jaguar, very minor resemblance of that. But it's really attractive. And the back of the car is really done very tastefully. And there's more room in the car than you could ever believe.
Yeah.
This will make a nice livery car for people that, you know, shuffle people around, like Ubers and Lyfts and stuff like that.
I want to throw this out there. I mean, what's the competition like these days globally when it comes to automakers? Are we starting to see any moves from some of the folks over in the Asian market, whether it's the Koreans? You mentioned the Hyundai. That was fantastic.
Oh, fantastic, the Ioniq, yeah. The Koreans have really come a long way with the vehicles. No more do we have the crappers. You know, the old saying years ago was, you know, why do some of these Hyundais and some of these other cars have a rear-end defroster? And the joke was, So when you push them in the winter, your hands wouldn't get cold. That's the old days. But no, they've come so far. One of the car companies that was the biggest around was Generous Motors. And, you know, right now General Motors is not doing so well. They have pulled out of a lot of the markets. You know, I can't tell you when the last time I if someone says, well, what do you think about a General Motors, whatever, you know what? You got to go on to something else, because I can't tell you anything about a GM vehicle. I haven't seen a GM vehicle in probably 6 or 8 months, other than a pickup truck, which is absolutely phenomenal, and a Corvette last year. That was a great car. But as far as the bread and butter cars of General Motors, you got to look in other directions. Unfortunately, that's the way it is right now.
How about the
You know, look at Subaru.
Yeah.
They've come a long way over the years.
Larry will be the first one to tell. It seems as though Subaru is coming up in the market and is being desirable. I want to say there's probably two or three people here at WATD who own Subarus. And in the other medium that I work in, a couple of my coworkers also have Subarus. And I'm like,
Well, one of the things about Subaru, it doesn't require any intelligence or driver input when you go from a nice asphalt-covered road to a snow-covered road.
Really?
You just drive. I mean, and they're not tinny rat boxes anymore. They really are not a bad vehicle. Is it something like I would really want to own? I would think not for me personally, because I want something when I step on the accelerator, I'm going to get a little bit of a rush.
Right.
And you don't get that. Even with the six-cylinder Subarus, and yep, Subaru has a flat boxer-style six-cylinder engine. It's got a little bit of get-up-and-go. And, you know, talk about going down the wedding line. Subaru and Toyota have gotten together with some of their vehicles, and they're marketing them back and forth. You know, the people like to go drifting.
Oh, right.
So they get drifting cars over at Toyota, and they're using the Subaru vehicles.
Hey, that's a big sport.
Yep. It's been a fun time for them, you know. But my industry is absolutely phenomenal. It really is. It's so exciting. Every day is something else. It's like, look at the radio industry that you and I are in, and that I was in for many years, and maybe someday I'll go back into it. But, you know, right now everything's on the Internet. We don't need ISDN lines. We don't need big Switch 56 boxes. All you need is an Internet connection.
Sure.
And it's crystal clear. It's amazing what we're seeing.
We talked a little bit about the Korean cars. How is China doing when it comes to being an automaker?
Well, you know what? I think that there's going to be some really big things happening over the next year or two. Pep Boys, that's been around 100 years, they sell everything like gas. They're looking to buy up a lot of independent shops. Now, my only thinking about that is the Chinese people are coming out with an automobile, and they may want to market those cars the same way that Tesla has, bypassing the traditional, you know, brick-and-mortar car dealership. And if they can do that, then they just need someone to do the warranty and repair work on it. And look at Pep Boys. They're all over the United States.
Mm-hmm.
So that could be something that you might see. And again, GM is, I wouldn't say they're in big trouble, but there's a lot of concerns what's going on over at Generous Motors, because they have lost a tremendous amount of market share.
What,
and, you know, you look at Toyota and Honda, geez, they are really kicking everybody's butt.
And also Ford. I mean, I really think, you know, what turned heads in the last few years is not just the different vehicles that they've revamped and reintroduced, but really kind of putting their foot down with the Ford GT, you know, revamp. And while that's a very limited car, obviously, and very expensive, I think it kind of showed everyone, and I read a lot of articles about how shocked people were that Ford was so dedicated to continuing different lines, like their race line and their luxury lines and those different lines, and really doing well in each of those divisions.
Well, you know, Ford has really gone a long way, come a long way over the years. They've gotten rid of pretty much the V8s in a lot of their vehicles. They're using little, you know, turbocharged four cylinders and six cylinder engines, and they really got some power. The new Raptor truck that they have that has more power this year with a count 'em up, a 10-speed automatic that's a joint venture with General Motors. And when you put the pedal to the metal, you're looking at around 550 RPM differentials in shift gears between the gears. It only drives, the engine drops about 550 RPM instead of 1,500 RPM. So you are bang, bang, bang when you put your leg into it. Plus, you have all of your driver modes. You don't need to download a computer download programmer anymore to go get all the power. You can just go right in through your sync radio system, and you can dial it up. It's amazing what they've done. Congratulations to them.
Yeah, I want to digress back to, you call them Generous Motors. You and I, when I used to produce your radio show back in the day, you used to call them Government Motors, because at that particular time,
they were owned by the government.
They were owned by the government. The government was giving them a nice, helping, serving, a nice serving of financial...
Our money,
infusing, trying to prop them up. Would you call this a failed experiment then?
I would think that General Motors, they are extremely selfish when it comes to paying the people that actually build the cars and make the cars. They are extremely selfish now, believe it or not, with journalists in providing cars. What General Motors has done is they've gotten a lot of their media PR now through the soccer moms. Anybody that has a blog basically can request it. Get a 2 or 3 day test drive. And what are you going to learn in 2 or 3 days about a car? Nothing. And if you have no experience about doing this kind of a job, where are you? You're nowhere. And it's really a problem, I think, because it has really turned around and bit General Motors in the behind with a lot of the media people. Like me, I don't care. But there are some journalists that really take it personal that they haven't been around too many GM cars out there to drive. But, it is what it is.
You would think that it would work in their favor to make sure that they at least have enough vehicles, in various regions of the United States for folks to be able to test drive them.
I would think that would be good. You just don't go and put a dog and pony show, as we call it, one or two day event to drive a car. You need a car for a week or so to understand it and feel it out and blah, blah, blah.
I mean, the higher-ups have to be understanding that what they're doing is they're killing free advertisement, because that's what this is. When you're taking this out there and you're taking it for a ride, there's a good chance you're going to write a graph or two about this, whether it's good, bad, or indifferent.
Yes, I would think that. But you know what? Kevin, Joe, it is what it is, and the people that are really up there in the sniffle zone, where they can't look down, they're not living in the real world anyway, so they have no idea. It's unfortunate, but you look at how Tesla is doing now and coming along. They're doing pretty gosh darn well, and I hope they can continue to go in the direction that they're going. But, that's a whole nother day, and we'll see what happens in 6 months. But right now, it doesn't look good, in my opinion.
What, speaking of other car manufacturers like Tesla, what do you see coming down the line in the next, even 6 months to a year in terms of cars? And I know there was usually this time of year starts to end the car shows that have happened over the course of the spring. What are some of the models that you are looking forward to?
Right?
Yeah, for 2018, even possibly 2019.
Well, we're going to see, and you can mark this down. You're going to see a tremendous amount of hybrid vehicles. And they're not going to look like a Prius anymore. They're going to look like a regular car, just like this Hyundai did that I had. Excuse me. And the hybrids, I think they're going to replace a lot more, of the fully electric vehicles.
Okay.
So let me grab a glass of water.
Again, we're speaking with Junior D'Amato, a gentleman who has not only spent his time doing radio programs, talking about whether it's cars that he's driven, talking about various problems with automobiles. And as he says, from time to time, I see in Gatehouse Media, they publish things folks can write into him and ask particular questions about. I have a 2003 Acura, and I'm having a problem with this.
So getting back to these automobiles,
yes.
Four cylinders, turbochargers are definitely here. The new oils that we're seeing, they're definitely going to stay with us. The annual oil change is going to be more sought out now because of the dealers and the car companies are saying, you know what, you can do an annual oil change in some countries under some conditions. Here in New England, you've got to do at least a semi-annual oil change because of the differences in weather temperatures in our roads.
Well, you say annual. Is annual, are we talking, what are we talking about, 10,000 miles? 5,000?
Okay.
10,000
plus.
Okay.
Hmm. And is that,
and we're going to see more and more of that as time goes on, Kevin.
Is that just because of the technology available in the oils nowadays?
It's not only the technology with the oil. It happens to be the technology with the cars we're driving.
Mm.
Years ago, when we had carburetors, we used to drive a car, and you know the car really runs good, but a lot of the gasoline that was going through the carburetor
get burned.
It ended up going into the crankcase.
Yep.
Now we have a terminology called stoichiometric, which is like 14.7:1 ratio. And when we had carburetors, we were just pouring gas into the engines,
right.
And you know, spark plugs would have to be changed, you know, maybe once or twice a year. Now it's 95,000 miles,
right?
Depending on the car, you know. And if you look at some of the transmission dipsticks, fluid does not need a change under normal driving conditions.
Yeah,
which
some,
is crazy, but
yeah, some cars are getting. I know I had a car that didn't even have a transmission dipstick.
The majority of them don't anymore, and a lot of cars don't even have engine oil dipsticks.
Wow!
So we're seeing a lot of changes as we go through the process of, you know, the automobile era. But you know, you have to look at it. It's like your television. The new televisions now are getting thinner, lighter, clearer, and they've come down in price.
Mm.
You look at a Toyota Corolla. It has all the safety features of a Mercedes 5 years ago that would have cost you $15,000. And it's in a fully loaded Corolla or a base Corolla that's right around $20,000. So we have made some big changes in the electronics, the pricing. It's like, you know, when's the last time you get up to change the channel on your television?
I haven't.
You're not going to. Now you have some of these cable boxes, you just talk to them.
Yep.
So we're seeing a lot of stuff. But one of the things that I think we should really touch on, I had three people in my shop today that asked me, point out, I'm going down with a friend of mine to the auction to buy a car. I said, that's great. What do you think you're going to spend? Well, maybe $3,000 or $4,000. I says, you're going to go to an auction with your buddy. There's no warranty because you're buying the car at an auction price. So you're going to be looking at a car $3,000 to $5,000, whatever the number is, that you know nothing about. Why do you think the car is at the auction?
Mm.
Well, I don't know. Well, it's very simple. It's because the dealership decided they didn't want the aggravation. An auction is a good place to go if you're going to buy a 2-year-old or 3-year-old off-lease vehicle. Other than that, you certainly don't want any part of it because unless you're in the business, you could end up, in plain English, getting screwed.
I have to ask you, as far as you talk about auctions and going, you were talking earlier as far as how things are changing when it comes to buying vehicles. The soon we may not see any brick and mortar buildings, you know, setups to buy vehicles. The other day
We're always going to see the brick and mortar buildings.
Yeah.
But if the Chinese come in with their particular way they want to do their sales,
right?
That particular line of cars, like Tesla, will not have the traditional manufacturer, car dealership to the retail consumer.
Mm. Well, you were mentioning that, and the other day I was watching TV, and I saw this ad for Carvana, where it was, they'll deliver a car to your house. You see it online. And what's your thoughts on something like that?
Well, some of the stuff that they have now where they deliver a car to your house, and you can actually, in New York, and this really beat up GM pretty badly, you can call up, you sign up, I forget what the dollar amount is, and you can get a new car every month. new, different car every month, delivered right to your office or your home from Cadillac. Mm. And I don't know how exactly that's going, but yeah, people are delivering vehicles to your house. You know, you can take a test drive, you can buy the car there, or lease the car, whatever the heck you want to do.
It's
There's all kinds of crazy stuff out there.
Well, and the way the ad goes is that, you know, it's they're eliminating the middleman. They're eliminating the sales experience when you're dealing with that novice of a salesperson who will tell you everything you want to hear, and the price is usually anywhere between $3,000 and $4,000 higher than MSRP.
Well, that doesn't make any sense to me at all. If someone's got more money than they know what to do with.
Right.
Well, Junior, you know, I have to tell you that I am possibly in the market for a new vehicle.
What are you buying?
Well, I don't know. I was thinking about one of the new Dodge Demons.
Yep, they're available.
Well, before we talk a little bit about my search for a car, tell us a little bit about your thoughts about the Dodge Demon. You know, it's the fastest production car to ever come out of a production line.
Dodge did a fabulous job with all of their SRT vehicles.
Yep.
As did Ford with their SVT vehicles. Dodge took it one step further, and for $84.95, you can get yourself an 808 horsepower Dodge Demon, the fastest production car made right now. For an extra few buckos, you can get the ECU in race fuel, and now you get 840 horsepower.
Wow.
The car runs 960 something and a quarter mile at 140 miles an hour. That is pro stock times 15 years ago with Sox and Martin, all the race car drivers. Back in that day, if you got into the nines, you had a pro car that had big fatty tires on it and could do one thing, a quarter mile. That was it.
Yeah, unbelievable.
But now you have the Demon, the Hellcat, the 392s, and all that other kind of stuff that Dodge has. And now you have the Jeep Trailhawk that's also powered by the Hellcat 707 horsepower vehicle.
Yep.
Coming out very shortly.
Yep. So
they've done a nice job.
Yeah, it really have. And I mean, I think it's a great marketing piece for them because they continue their performance of their vehicles. So I guess my first thought is, you know, talk to, you know, not just me, but obviously our audience about when you're looking for a new vehicle and potentially trying to figure out what the best options are, mostly between buying and leasing. Because I think for most people, that becomes a challenge for them to try to figure it out.
This is it. This is Junior's wheelhouse right here.
Let's see if we can get through this. I know you guys are running a little short of time.
Yeah.
Okay. Leasing a vehicle. You watch any TV commercial, three or four in a row, back to back. They're trying to lease you the car. They want to get you into the car for anywhere from 30 months to 36 months.
Yep.
And the price is really attractive. It's the lease price is basically what the car depreciates a month on average, give or take a few buckos. And at the end of the lease, they put what they call a residual on the car. That's what they feel that car is going to be worth. And that's how your lease price is based. So let's say that your kid's in school, college, whatever. You got two kids in college, and you don't have a lot of money right now to buy that new car, but you need a new car because of the job. And, you know, your only option would be buy a used car or lease a new car. Well, you know what? Lease that new car if that's what it has to be. At the end of the lease, you can choose to, you ready for this? Release it, buy it outright at the residual, or just give it back and get another one. And 99% of the time, the car dealer will call you about 80% into that lease and see if they can get you into another lease for maybe even a little less money, and they'll take care of washing out the rest of your lease payments. That's how we keep the evolution going, and we get you back in the store again. And that's a big plus. Leasing is not for everybody, and in some cases, you can lease a pre-owned car as well. But you are still responsible for all the service, taxes, and all the blah, blah, blah. But if you lease that new car for the 3 years, you basically have almost no responsibility except putting gas and an oil change unless it's covered. There's a lot of good things about it. But again, leasing is not for everybody. And there are some people in places now where you can lease a used car.
I want to take a moment.
It's something that you have to look at very closely.
Before you go, before we say goodbye to you, you always leave our listeners with some kind of a tip, whether it's don't fall for the, you know, buy three tires, get one free deal, stuff like that. Impress upon us some of the things that folks should be aware of if they are in the market for a new mechanic, or they're looking to find a garage, maybe they're new to the area.
That should be pretty simple. If you're looking to get your car serviced and you want to look, you know, you don't know where to go, go to, you know, Help Middleborough, Help Halifax, Help Plymouth.
Yep.
That's number one. You'll find a lot of good information there. Yelp is always a good one. You go to AAA and find an approved repair garage, because when you go to one of those garages or an approved repair facility at AAA, you not only have a technician that's qualified and certified, you also have a bartering tool called AAA. If something isn't the way it has to be,
right,
AAA gets right in and mediates the situation. If you're going to buy a car, be careful of all of the high-pressure after-sell after the fact. And one thing that's really got to me over the years is that dock fee. One of my clients just bought a new car, and the documentation fee was $429.
Yeah, it's crazy.
I said, for what? I said, you know what? Now that the dealers are doing that, that dock has to be on, the dock fee has to be on the bill of sale. But what they can elect to do is to give you a $400 discount or $300 discount or whatever if it comes down to breaking sticks whether you buy the car or not. But the dock fee has to be left on the slip. They can elect to maybe give you free car washes for a year or
oil changes,
know, whatever it might be. But they cannot take that other thing off. The dock fee has to stay on the receipt that you're getting, the car to bill of sale.
All right, well, I guess in our final moments here, Junior, really quick, looking to something, you know, not that expensive, probably a lease, runs good, a little bigger than a small sedan, your number one suggestion?
Well, again, it depends what you want out of this thing. You want a rear-wheel drive, front-wheel drive? You know, you have to go and look around. There are so many vehicles out there. And again, don't snub your nose up at the Korean cars.
Sure.
The only thing wrong with the Korean car companies right now, or their vehicles, is that the resale is not as good as Toyota, Honda. Mm. But other than that, those cars, there's nothing wrong with them. They have a nice long warranty. They, you know, some of those little SUVs, they're pretty gosh darn good.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and I've seen so many good cars out there. And again, I get to drive a new one every week. I got a great job.
Well, Junior, we want to thank you for joining us. We want to thank Miss Carla and the cats for letting you join us for a half hour and talk shop. And
Miss Lisa says hello.
Yes. Make sure you tell your top wrench, Richie, I said hi.
And you tell Miss Lisa we said hello. And I called Richie and Lisa yesterday. I told them that Christmas in July starts on Hallmark in about 2 weeks. And he just said there's something wrong with that, man. You guys have a great one.
You have a great one as well. There he is, Junior D'Amato. Monday Night Talk's own auto expert. I like to say that anyways. Joe, it's been great having you back in studio.
Thank you. We'll have to do this more often if you invite me more often.
Okay, well, it depends. Again, you're flying out to Montana for, you know, to speak to folks about flood insurance. And, you know, you're big time now. You're big timing us.
I've hit the big time.
You definitely have. But, hey, that's all the time that we have here. Until next week at 6:15 p.m., have yourself a great evening.
Good night.